just as a sample of the really rich tradition that we have scripturally in terms of biblical texts that do have a direct bearing on the question of social justice. And it seems to me that Philemon is one of the extraordinary texts in that regard. Philemon was a presumably wealthy Christian in, I can't even remember where he lived. Anybody remember? Shouldn't have asked. But the letter is to Philemon. It's really about Onesimus, who was a slave owned by Philemon, and apparently not a very good one because he was a runaway slave. Paul was in prison. He evidently knew about Paul, knew something of Paul's work, but was not evidently not a Christian. But he ran away, and he found Paul in prison. And now Paul is sending him back to his owner, Onesimus, or Philemon, rather. And as you can tell from this, Paul is virtually telling Philemon, free this man. Don't receive him back any longer as a slave, but as a brother in Christ. And though he doesn't say it in so many words, set this man free, the implication is so clear. And the underpinnings, you know, that in Christ there is neither slave nor free, Greek nor Jew, male nor female, etc. But all are one in Christ. You know, the implications of that come out so strongly here. Again, Paul isn't laying out a platform here for the whole society saying, let's free the slaves. But the implications of this for society were enormous and I think historically demonstrable. Anyway, the lesson starts at verse 10. And let me also say there are a few puns in here. The word Onesimus, the name of the slave, means useful. And Paul uses the word useful and useless here as a pun when he writes to Philemon, and later in the part that I'll read, he uses the word benefit, which is really, again, the same word, Onesimus, benefit, useful, or same root word. All right, starting with verse 10, I appeal to you for my child Onesimus, whose father I have become in my imprisonment. Formerly he was useless to you, but now he is indeed useful, Onesimus, to you and to me. I'm sending him back to you, sending my very heart. I would have been glad to keep him with me in order that he might serve me on your behalf during my imprisonment for the gospel. But I preferred to do nothing without your consent in order that your goodness might not be by compulsion but of your own free will. Perhaps this is why he was parted from you for a while, that you might have him back forever. No longer as a slave, but more than a slave, as a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. So if you consider me your partner, receive him as you would receive me. If he has wronged you at all or owes you anything, charge that to my account. I, Paul, write this with my own hand. I will repay it, to say nothing of your owing me, even your own self. Yes, brother, I want some benefit from you in the Lord. Refresh my heart in Christ. Confident of your obedience, I write to you, knowing that you will do even more than I say. Shall we pray? Lord, you are the one who indeed sets us free in Christ. And for that we give great thanks. You not only set us free, but you make us useful in Christ, and you open the ways for us to be useful with our lives. Please grant that we may be useful people as we celebrate your kingdom through Jesus Christ our Lord. Okay, today it's 100 Home and Abroad Connections, and we'll try to make some, just comment a bit about hunger here in the States, and then try to make some links, show some similarities between hunger here and hunger abroad, also some distinctions. Thought I'd start by reading a clipping that came out of the Seattle Sunday newspaper. I've been really, like most of you, I guess, completely devoid of the news, and I happened to bump into a Sunday paper out there on the table Sunday or Monday and noticed this and clipped it out. It's a little, it's in a section, I guess, that is summarizing some news from the previous week, and this starts out under the section The Nation, and the headline is Perplexed Reagan is Given Plenty of Food for Thought. Helpful people across the nation last week sprang to the enlightenment of President Reagan, who said he was perplexed, quote, perplexed, at reports that there was widespread hunger, since he thought the problem was being taken care of. As Reagan announced he was appointing a 12-member task force to look into the enigma, officials who minister to the country's poor invited Reagan to see for himself the nationwide hunger epidemic and hinted that his administration may have had something to do with it. They were joined by members of Congress, most notably House Speaker Thomas O'Neill. They cited unemployment, food stamp cutbacks, cuts in federal funds for cities, reductions in subsidized school lunches, and curtailed federal distribution of surplus commodities as examples. The Census Bureau also reported that 34.4 million Americans, 15% of the population, fell below the poverty line in 1982, the largest percentage since 1965. The Agriculture Department, however, promised that an additional 18 million pounds a month of surplus cheese, grains, and dairy products would be released to the needy in the near future. And then it goes on a little bit more. So anyway, that's kind of an interesting article. The question came up Monday, what I thought of the appointment of this task force, and was that not just a political move? Basically, I'm very happy about the appointment of the task force. It may or may not be politically motivated. I guess I have my private hunches, but I think it's something that is almost certain to give the problem more attention. One of the interesting things about these commissions or task forces, even though an administration will try to appoint a relatively friendly bunch of people to these things so they will not come up with embarrassing information, they tend to take on a life of their own, and people's reputations are at stake, and usually they'll come up with stuff that's made public, which can be very helpful on, I think, an issue like this. So I think of it as a plus and potentially big plus.
All right, what were the numbers on people below the poverty line?
34.4 million. 15%. That's about in 79 it was 11.5 million. That was up a little bit from 78. I don't recall the percentages there. And it's a 34.4 is approximately 7 million more under the poverty line than there were in 79. So it's up by about, that makes it about 4.5. 11.5 to 15, that would be 3.5 percentage points. Okay. And about 2 million people, roughly, for every percentage point.
What is the income considered poverty line?
I was afraid somebody's going to ask that. I don't know exactly what it is. I think it is 8,000 something a year for an urban family of four. Uh-huh. But I don't know the exact figure. Yeah. The way they figure this, unless it's changed, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has what it calls a thrifty food plan, something like that. They figure out what it takes to feed a family of four using nutritious, inexpensive items. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to be a short-term kind of a stopgap way of furnishing people with adequate nutrition, not intended to be a long-range diet, but but if it's used wisely and well, you can feed yourself adequately for at least a while on this X number of dollars. They multiply that by three then, figuring that a family who is on the poverty line has to spend twice that much on non-food items such as housing and medical expenses and clothing and so on. So it's, that's the way they arrive at it.
Quite a difference from India, huh?
Oh, yeah, quite a difference, without a doubt, yeah. And one of the things that, well, I'll say it now, I was going to say it later. Peter Drucker, in one of his books, says, you know, poverty here in the States is what people, what poor people abroad aspire to. You know, they, it's not the riches here in the States that impress them. They've seen riches in their own country, often more ostentatious than is typical here. But, you know, but poverty here in the States is compared to what they experience. Some, you know, it's very affluent. Now, having said that, there are some other things that need to be said about poverty here in the States, which is not so good, and you know, even by comparison with poverty abroad. And I will comment on that later. One of the interesting things, one of the sad things really, is that we don't know how many people in the United States are hungry, are undernourished. We just don't keep those kind of statistics, and probably the main reason we don't is that they're embarrassing. Several years ago, Bread for the World attempted to get we drafted legislation, attempted to get it passed, which would have set up a national system of nutritional monitoring, which would have scientifically gotten at numbers and intensity, and would have been able to then diagnose the whole thing much more accurately and figure out, well, who was hurting where and why, and perhaps get some indication at least of then how, you know, what were the gaps, what were the reasons for that, and how could we then best address situation for people still hungry. We couldn't get that thing passed. We got a lot of interest in it, but it did not go through. We did then the following year, I think in 1980, get it in as a part of the of the 1980 Farm Bill, or 81 Farm Bill, 80 Farm Bill, I think it was. But in a truncated form, it was set up as a pilot project, nutritional monitoring on a pilot project basis, not as comprehensive as what we had wanted. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has been charged with the responsibility for setting that up and doing it. It has taken a long, long time for the USDA to piece this thing together, and it still is not being implemented as far as I know. They've been really dragging their feet on it. Again, I think because they're worried about the embarrassment that may result. Bread for the World has been active on the domestic hunger issue as well as international, and just happen to have some papers along with me. I'll put these out here. I'd prefer that you not take them because they're my only copies, and I brought them because I need to use them for something else that I'm working on. One is a Preventing Hunger at Home background paper. Each year we do what we call an offering of letters of Bread for the World. We invite members and other friends and congregations across the country to have a campaign or an offering of letters in the congregation. A lot of churches will ask their people to write letters on a hunger issue and address it to a member of Congress and put it in the offering basket in church on Sunday morning. And then they're mailed off. And it always generates a lot of public support for some issue. Well, this year we put in a Preventing Hunger at Home resolution in Congress and had an offering of letters campaign around that. And this background paper gives some material on it. That's gone very well. The Senate has passed it. In the House, we have almost a majority of sponsors in the House. We expect to get it passed in the House in September when Congress reconvenes. But meanwhile, it's already served most of its purpose, which has been to be a rallying point to a certain extent in the public, but more particularly in Congress, for saying no more cutbacks on food assistance programs. And in fact, it looks like we're going to be able to get some restoration of funding for a few programs, or partial restoration. So, Preventing Hunger at Home is one thing. Two other background papers that relate to Domestic hunger, one is hunger at home. Another one, that was from last November, another one is called sharing the burden. Now this is on the impact of the budget and tax cuts on poor people and its relationship to hunger. And as the middle diagram indicates, this was reprinted by the National Catholic Reporter, households with incomes above $47,800 gained $9.2 billion last year as a result of the tax cuts and the program cuts. Households with incomes below $11,500 lost $8 billion. So there have been significant shifts in income the last few years and years ahead. Hungry for Work, a newer background paper related to the whole issue of unemployment and hunger, and a couple of the of newsletters, July and August issues of our newsletter. These are the basic vehicles for letting people know what's happening on issues and what to write about. Okay. Also just mentioned in passing, though Jenny Nelson will talk about this on Friday. She's going to talk about local organizing, what can be done locally in the congregation or with a local membership or a local group. And she'll talk a bit about Hunger Watch. That's another thing that we've put out there, which a lot of local people picked up, and that is just a way of conducting a local hunger survey and finding out locally what's going on, who are the people who are hungry, and how are they being helped, or how are they being missed, and then reporting this to the press. It's a good way of getting some visibility locally on the hunger issue, and also then feeding information that's useful to us in terms of working with Congress. Now, some links between hunger here at home and abroad. I said yesterday, regarding the causes of hunger, that people are hungry because they are very poor, and that would apply here at home as well as abroad. Here in the States as well, you find hungry people among the very poor. Now, admittedly, you may occasionally find some eccentric middle-income or wealthy person who, is not able to take care of himself or herself, or some quirk like that, but sometimes related to emotional and mental disorder, but really what we're talking about basically is people who are hungry because they're very poor. Again, the powerlessness often, or feeling of powerlessness at least, associated with that is common here in the States as well as abroad. Many of the other things that I cited regarding the causes of hunger, while I was thinking primarily of the situation in developing countries, would be applicable here too. The lack of access to resources of various kinds, lack of opportunities, unemployment, underemployment, and so on. Secondly, the hungry, both here in the States and in developing countries, are affected by interlocking economies. The whole world is really much more interdependent economically than it's ever been. And that, that is increasingly the case as time goes on, and presumably will continue to be the case. These years, with the worldwide recession, it's had an impact, a negative impact on hungry people, both here and abroad. Where you have recession, you've got more unemployment, you've got more poverty, and you've got more hunger. That's true here, it's true in developing countries. The recession has had a more devastating impact on the developing countries than it has had on us, and therefore, it's done more that's detrimental to, aggravate or create more hunger abroad than it has here in the States. And we think we are hurting by unemployment, by the recession. Well, the developing countries are hurting a great deal more. Another example of the interlocking economies and how it affects hungry people is the debt burden that the developing countries are carrying. And that debt has just soared these last years. it's roughly doubled since 1979. Mexico, for example, has $80 billion debt right now. And like a lot of other countries, Mexico has had to reschedule some of the debt payments, and in order to continue qualifying for credit, both with the IMF and with private banks, the IMF has come in and they've negotiated austerity measures that have been imposed on Mexico. And some of those austerity measures include cutbacks in government services, some measures that will increase unemployment, lower the standard of living, especially for the very poor. So some things, you know, happen there that are not entirely unsimilar to some of the trends that have taken place here in our own country in the last couple of 2-3 years. One of the interesting implications of that too is where you've got a harsher situation in Mexico, where poverty is increasing, you're going to have more pressure on poor Mexicans crossing the border, and the whole complication of illegal aliens coming in from Mexico is on the increase. One final example of the links between hunger here and abroad, and also to show how these hunger issues connect with one another, I'd like to just briefly link unemployment here with trade as a hunger issue for the developing countries. Said yesterday that, you know, people are hungry because they're poor. One of the reasons they're poor is that they don't have jobs. One of the reasons they don't have jobs is that countries aren't developing as well as they might the kinds of industries that would provide employment to people. One of the reasons they don't develop those industries more is that you can only develop industries if you got markets for the products that those industries would produce. And a constraint against that is trade barriers that countries like the United States impose on developing countries. And the barriers tend to go higher as goods are processed and become more highly manufactured. The barriers on raw materials are virtually non-existent. But as countries take those raw materials and begin to process them, and or even come out with finished products, then the tariffs go up, the quotas go up, and various barriers like that. Now, why does a country like ours impose trade barriers, which obviously have a detrimental impact on hunger? Well, we do it because we've got an unemployment problem here, and we want to protect our workers. There's a lot of protectionist sentiment and a lot of fear, justified fear, on the part of workers here in the States and industries, not just the workers, management too, often, that unless there are safeguards, limits on imports, that's going to really undercut industries here, and more people will be thrown out of work. So unless we get at, more effectively, at the problem of unemployment here, we're going to have a built-in lobby, and a very effective built-in lobby, you know, against providing the kind of trade concessions for the developing countries that would greatly help them lick the hunger problem. Most economists will say that if we lowered the trade barriers, gave developing countries more opportunities here, everybody would benefit. Almost everybody, I should say, not everybody. As a whole, consumers here in the States would benefit. We would be able to purchase many things much more cheaply. But the burden would fall unevenly on certain industries and workers who would be adversely affected by, say, the import of more textiles or whatever. And we are not very good at learning how to share the burden. I mean, what would have to happen would be we'd have to find ways of getting the benefits, the economic benefits of bringing more goods in from developing countries, and recycling those benefits by providing new opportunities for the workers and the industries who've been adversely affected through retraining, through retooling of industries, either bringing them, you know, upgrading them technologically, or maybe shifting, helping industry shift into other areas of production. But that's the kind of thing that would need to happen. And because it's not happening, you know, unemployment here is causing not only hunger here, but hunger abroad as well, and preventing developing countries from moving more in the area of production and jobs. Well, those are some of the links between hunger here and hunger abroad. There are some differences too. As I've already indicated, it's a lot worse in the developing countries. It doesn't mean it's not bad here, and it doesn't mean that there aren't many instances here where it is exceedingly bad, and you know, where it can match anything you'd find in a developing country. But on the whole, poverty here is not as acute. However, expectations are a lot higher here in the States. And, you know, people see this every day. Anytime they take a bus ride or turn on their television, I mean, you know, poor people here in the States are not unaware of their situation vis-a-vis the rest of the population. And so the expectation level here in the States is much, much higher than, for example, Senegal or Niger, where I was earlier this summer. And here in the States, you've got a kind of a blame the victim syndrome at work. We talked a bit about that yesterday, too. Here in the States, there's, you know, there's a much different psychology at work regarding hunger and poverty. There's more loss of dignity, more loss of status and self-respect associated with being poor here in the States compared to being poor in some other countries. Here it's a stigma of failure, whereas in other countries there's an understanding that, you know, that most people are poor, and that is not a result of moral failure. A third difference is that solutions are not always the same here to hunger and poverty here in the States as they are in developing countries. Many developing countries, for example, if a person has a few acres of land and access to at least, you know, some basic inputs or resources to use that land well, access to credit maybe, so that the farmer can buy some seeds and tools and farm the land well, they can make a go of it. You know, here, if a farm family has a few acres, you know, there's no way you can hack it. And I know, maybe there is if you're growing mushrooms or, I mean, there probably are some things in some cases that would be exceptions. I think a 20-acre strawberry farm in California probably is a viable family farm if it's really farmed intensively. But, you know, 20 acres in Kansas is not going to help much. 20 acres in Washington, I guess, won't be very good either.
Another thing on the attempt to seek political economic solutions to these problems, which is sometimes in dilemma, where they're not going to be adequate, basically because we function very often in both areas out of self-interest. Yesterday we discussed the need of the developing worlds, first of all, to be able to produce food supply adequate for their own people, which means a very, very strong agricultural emphasis within their development plans, which rules out for a large part an industrial or commercial development, which is the thing that the so-called developed world sees as their way out of the problem. And if imposed upon the developing world, it puts them in a situation where they're not going to be able to produce the food. It brings unemployment in as a problem, which normally doesn't exist in an truly agricultural society. But from the point of view of the developed world, also in their markets. When you consider that a third of the export market of the United States goes to the developing world, what happens then if that developing world is not asking for those things or doesn't need them in their agriculture production? So unless we come to a point where our self-interest can be at least suppressed for the sake of these people, till they come to a point where they can feed themselves and then begin to get involved in the industrial commercial areas, then we're just up against it, I see. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's an interesting set of comments, and I think illustrates how interrelated all these things are. You know, it's
I think a good example of this, you know, in a country like Tanzania, where the emphasis from the beginning was to remain agricultural, and where unemployment would not be a problem, non-involvement could be, mm-hmm, not mm-hmm. non-employment, you end up in looking for loans or for grants, dealing with the IMF and the World Bank, whose whole emphasis has been on industrialization. Mm-hmm. And then the pressure that comes from the one who has the funds to determine how they're going to be used. Mm-hmm. So where you have an experiment in an attempt to go agricultural, even that has been wiped, where funds are being withheld until the country agrees to go the way of the funders. Mm-hmm. And it brings tremendous pressure to bear upon what you might call the more enlightened leaders of the developing world, who see these things as much as we do in terms mm-hmm. of agriculture. Mm-hmm. Society has been 93% agriculturalist, wanting to remain that way in order to be able to produce enough food for its people, being forced out of that area, getting into problems, not only economic problems, but also social problems, where you destroy the roots of a family that has been basic agriculture, because they just can't come up to the expectations of those who have the funds. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I don't think we can deal with this on economic and on political. We've got to deal on it as a family. Mm-hmm. That's where I come back to the point of the church in these things, you see. You've got a very strong group that belongs to the spiritual family, which remembers. Probably not political or economic, but spiritually. You know, where there are a large number of Christians over there who are being, well, I might say, forced to suffer because mm-hmm. of these other things coming in. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to relate to them as members of the same spiritual family anyway mm-hmm. on these things. Well, see where we can lose some of our, you know, our self-interest mm-hmm. in development.
Let me, we had a long talk after breakfast this morning, so that in a way I'm setting up here, but what do you see, you know, as a person who's worked many years in Tanzania, what do you see Christians here doing in relation to what's needed in your country?
Well, I think much of it's going to have to come through by making use of organizations like your own. I mean, when you're lobbying for legislation which affects food distribution, you might say, in the developing world, as well as issues in this country, to be able to put some pressure on those who are in positions, you know, of influence, even within the IMF, I mean, we're the big ones, and World Bank, we're also the big ones, to face the issues more basically as they are. Now they're coming back to say, well, let's have agricultural
basis in the trend,
but it's taken us 10 years.
Yeah.
In the meantime, they wiped out one of the pilot projects, you know, that it would have had a good chance of success had they not been so stringent before in their demands. You see, but they weren't willing to put funding into an agricultural economy because the only thing that goes is industry. Mm-hmm. In fact, what way has the world to measure so-called development? Gross national product. You see? That's our measurement. And Tanzania said, well, that's not our concern. How much can we produce? Because even in a country that has a huge gross national product, you can have abject poverty. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Gulf states, for instance, the GNP is huge there, but you got people who are suffering for having nothing.
Sure.
So Tanzania has said, well, you've got to have another way of measuring what it means to be a person in this society. And in terms of health, education, community, and so they come up with a quality of living quotient, mm-hmm. which most people don't understand. Yeah. Is that development? You know, development is getting that second car, you know, getting an extra place to go for vacations, these type of things. not what it means to be related together within a family, what it means to have the grandparents and the grandchildren together in a unit so the culture can be passed, sharing, openly, these type of things, is real living.
Yeah.
You see, so the difficulty is we've probably awakened too late, but the thing I think is if we as a member of that church begin to realize what we are and to function that way, we can bring pressure to bear, as you've been able to do on some of these issues, even on those that maybe this experiment was one that should have been at least tolerated to see what the results could have been, rather than putting, you know, uninformed pressure on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then about the time it's ready to go down, we change our views on the entire world, developing world, and say, well, this is what we're going to do from now on. In all the places, you lost the best example you had.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had a leadership that was dedicated to it.
Mm-hmm. Still is, though, right?
Well, now the pressures are coming in, you see. They piled off the loan in the IMF until the whole system has changed.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And at the same time, you know, they got $60 million from IMF after negotiating 5 years for it.
Mm-hmm.
And overnight, $30 million goes to Kenya as an outright gift to the leadership because they've got the American Navy sitting there trying to protect the mm-hmm. Gulf. They didn't ask for it, they were given it.
Mm-hmm.
You see? It's the politics of it.
Yeah, I don't know what Tanzania's indebtedness is, but I know one of the problems that we're concerned about is not just, you know, emphasis on the industrial sector rather than agricultural sector, but when a country becomes indebted and has to pay off that debt, then the push toward getting them to get into the export traffic more. And related to that, then, you know, the emphasis even in the agricultural sector of export crop sales.
But I mean, now who's going to benefit in the developing world from producing something which the developed world is also marketing? Then the commodity markets, where the prices are controlled.
Well, isn't that also true, like in Brazil, of the example of where that's a country that has agricultural capability, but they're typically using it on export products such as coffee, which is a product that we like to buy at a nice cheap rate. And where Brazil might be able to be much more self-sufficient agriculturally if they weren't so tempted to just grow coffee. And there's other examples too, Art, of that.
Yeah. Well, and soybeans in Brazil too, they've gone into soybeans in a big way too. Sometimes at the at the expense of the local staple foods.
And Brazil has tried to become an industrial nation, and yet all the people are moving to the cities where they just have ramshackle shacks and terrible slum conditions.
That's right.
That's true.
Yeah. And Brazil has been called the economic miracle because it's grown at such a rapid rate. I mean, for about a decade, it was growing at about 10% a year. I mean, it was just phenomenal.
Mm.
But you get
GNP.
You get all the but GNP, and you get all the extremes. You know, you get a certain segment of the population that is getting, you know, getting well-to-do, getting richer. But then you get an enormous section of the population that really is going nowhere, is still in the pits.
Can you follow a little farther along with the example of coffee and how, is that an example of something that we control prices on pretty carefully? How do we deal with this?
I'm not an expert on this particular thing. I can give a rough shot at it. The price of coffee is set on the international market. I mean, it's a free market thing, and it depends on the supply and demand at any given time, and that fluctuates enormously depending on the, you know, sometimes there's a big freeze in Brazil, and a third of the crop is destroyed, and the price of coffee goes way up. You know, they may earn more as a result of the freeze, and better crop. So the prices of these things tend to fluctuate enormously. Sugar would be another example where, you know, in the world market, the price can be 60 cents a pound 1 year and 9 cents a pound the other. The next
I thought
year.
Brazil and some of these countries are controlling the export of coffee, at least to a certain degree.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent that is the case. I'm sure they make some efforts to do it. In general, efforts among developing countries to work in concert and agree on limitations of production and, you know, efforts that would in effect help to set prices at a reasonably good level have not been very successful, just because every country wants to get a little bit of an advantage, and it's hard to get them all to stick by an agreement.
Maybe another part that you were referring to in this whole thing is this whole idea of cash crops, where a country turns over its entire agricultural economy to the export of a particular crop because it's profitable, and then people have no land left to which to raise their own food.
That's a problem. Now, they wouldn't turn the entire economy over to it, but yeah, right. But what does happen is that often a great deal of very valuable land will be turned over to production for export sale, and at the expense of food that otherwise would be produced for local consumption. And that's a problem.
Art, I'd be interested if you'd comment on the situation, the new PIC program, Reagan's PIC program, mm-hmm. where we're giving farmers other grains, not to grow the grain that they're typically,
right.
And the surpluses. I don't think it's been until recently that I've been so aware of the huge amount of surplus foods. I know something about what's happening in state Washington about the distribution of surplus cheese and milk and so on. I know this in June we were told, you know, you're not going to get any more for a while because there's not enough cheese being sold in the market. Cheese people are upset because people aren't buying cheese as much. Well, obviously, if we're distributing tons of cheese to poor people, they're going to be using their food stamps to buy other things. So because of that pressure, all of a sudden, the cheese thing was curtailed for a couple of months. I guess it's going to come back again. But I grow a garden, but I'm not a farmer.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the dilemma of the farmer exactly. But it seems almost immoral to me that we have this wonderful ground out there that's just absolutely left, you know, just plowed under, where we could be growing, you know, a tremendous amount of food,
mm-hmm.
even though our goal is to make people self-sufficient. At least in the interim, we ought to be helping people to live from day to day. And here we have the ability, it seems to me, to, you know, as they say, quote unquote, feed the world. We've made some decisions not to do that, and we made some decisions, you know, to, you know, keep the price up and do some other things. And I'm wondering if you could comment on the whole dilemma.
Yeah, I'd like to. Let me comment. Are there any farmers here? All right. But maybe when I'm finished, if you'd like to jump in and add something, I'd be happy to let you talk, because you're really talking about two things, one is what do I think of the PIC? PIC stands for payment in kind. Is that something that everybody's familiar with, or no? I see most people shaking heads yes, and a few shaking heads no. Well, we've had over the past few years we've had good grain crops, and the surpluses have piled up, and prices have been quite depressed for farmers. That's been a real problem. And as you know, many family farmers have been going out of business the last few years because of that. So here's the administration faced with a problem both of piling up surpluses and a depressed farm sector and a lot of unhappy farmers. What's it going to do? Well, came up with the ingenious idea, it is an ingenious idea, of paying farmers. The idea of paying farmers not to to put land out of production is not new. That's been going on for a long time. But instead of cash payments, pay them with the grain that's already in storage and let them put that grain onto the market. So you get rid of the surpluses and pay the farmers for not putting more land into production all at the same time. And that's okay as far as it goes. If you could really control that thing and know exactly where to cut it off, probably would be a workable and very defensible plan. We're concerned about it, we're worried about it, because it's hard really to control that carefully. And we may very well get ourselves into the situation where, worldwide, we don't have all that much of a of a cushion. The carryover stock from year to year is, I don't know what the percentage is right now, but it's not that high. I mean, it's not as high as it should be worldwide. So that if we hit one or two really bad years, we could run into the same kind of situation we had in the early 70s, where lots of countries had acute food shortages and many people were dying. So we don't think that's the kind of risk we ought to be taking. What we would much rather see the U.S. do with some of the surpluses is use that as an opportunity for helping to develop what has been needed for decades, and that is an international system of national reserves, internationally coordinated system of national reserves. We do have a farmer-owned and farmer-held grain reserve here in the States. We also have a smaller companion emergency grain reserve to serve as a backstop for food aid. And those are two important components. They probably need changing. The farmer-owned grain reserve probably has to have the trigger points changed. It's when, you know, when the incentives are put out there for farmers to sell the grain on the market. And it probably needs to be enlarged, and so does the international grain reserve, or the emergency grain reserve. But we also need to use some of this as inducement for helping other countries set up reserves too. We could have a much better food security system internationally. I mean, that's maybe a long-winded answer to the first part of the question. Second part of the question, boy, I agonize over that one because it is, you know, it seems so wrong, you know, such a contradiction for us to have too much food here in the States. And you have hungry and starving people around the world. But the answer, as hard as it may seem to us, the answer is not for the United States simply to be shipping lots more of that stuff abroad. We've done too much of that in the past. Back in the 50s and 60s, we had this mounting grain surplus developing. That was really why the PL 480 Food for Peace program came into being, as a way primarily of getting rid of the, you know, dealing with our farm problem here and the mounting surpluses, and at the same time feeling there was a need abroad, so let's match our need with that one and, you know, get it over there. All well and good up to a point. The problem was that we often were just dumping food abroad, depressing prices in developing countries, and therefore undercutting local farmers, and that became a disincentive to increased food production. And it was easy then for countries to they had cheap food that made the urban populations happy, that made the political situation more stable, easier to handle, short run at least. It also enabled and encouraged them to postpone paying more attention to the agricultural sector and the need to do a lot more in terms of more food production internally. So that's why I say food aid has to be used very, very carefully. I think only under two conditions. Either when there's an emergency and there's nothing else you can do except get food over right away or people are going to die. Oh, but that's starvation. That's not chronic malnutrition, which is a far more pervasive problem. Or when food aid is directly linked to agricultural development. That is to say, when it's linked directly to enabling the country become more food productive so that it's, you know, there's some self-help and a move towards self-reliance in food taking place. An example of that might be food for work projects, where maybe farm families or villagers in a rural area are paid in food for building roads or developing small-scale irrigation projects for doing things that's going to enable the people of that area or those villages to, in the long pull, do for themselves and not be relying on more food assistance. But it seems to me if we go beyond those two conditions, then we are using food aid in a way that probably causes more hunger than it prevents.
Do you feel that all countries, or what proportion do you feel that countries can become self-supporting in raising their own food and raising their level up to non-poverty level? Seems
yeah.
to me there are a lot of them that never would reach that point, would they?
I think that's correct. I mean, I do not think it is realistic to expect every country to be self-sufficient in food, you know, all by itself. I didn't use the term self-sufficient, and I know you can use these terms in different ways. I use the term self-reliance, more self-reliant in food. I don't think that means you know, not engaging in trade with other countries. I think there are plenty of cases where, you know, exporting some food does make sense because they can make more money off that, and, you know, in turn maybe buy some wheat or corn or whatever, and everybody be better off for it because they're specializing in something they can do better. And there are certainly, I mean, Japan would be an example of a country. Japan is never going to be self-sufficient in food. You know, it shouldn't try to be. Japan is always going to rely on an aggressive, high-tech industrial sector so it can buy what it needs beyond what it produces in food. And, you know, there are other examples of that, too. In some cases, well, like in Senegal and Niger, they could support a larger population than they have if that larger population would come a little more gradually, and they'd have more time to develop their agricultural capability. The problem is that it's coming too fast. The population is growing too fast, you know, it takes time to do the kind of ag development that's necessary.
Well, I've often thought that, of course, this kind of utopian, that if the United States would export surplus farm products instead of their non-surplus dollars, that it would probably everybody be better off, but I suppose it would create problems in some places. Plus the fact that a capitalistic nation will never do that.
Yeah, and you want to be reasonably sure. You were, I think, making that point too in a different way. You know that you don't want to just send dollars or other kinds of assistance to any old government because, you know, a lot depends on how they use it and what kind of overall economic policies they have. You know, are the poor people of the country going to really benefit from that? I mean, that is a critical question.
And I doubt if a lot of them do. At least you always keep hearing these stories about that it's useless to export food to countries because it never gets to the places it belongs anyway. It hardly gets off the docks before it's usurped by somebody or other.
Well,
I don't know how much truth there is in that.
But there's some truth, but not nearly as much as people often think. I mean, it's like you know, the food stamp program and its abuse here in the States. You tend to hear the bad examples, and they when there is abuse, you know, that makes the stories in the newspaper. But what you tend not to hear is the fact that overall the program has been enormously successful in helping to reduce hunger in the state. I think probably the same thing is, well, I don't know how to figure percentages, but overall, you know, the same thing would apply to food assistance going abroad. Sure, there are plenty of examples of where it was, where it's misused, but overall it's, you know, it does have a good use. And there, you know, think of Cambodia a few years back. You know, Cambodia was an extremely desperate situation where, you know, several million people were literally either starving or on the edge of starvation. And there was an enormous effort to get some immediate assistance over there. There were at the time stories that came back, were printed, and some that I heard that weren't printed, you know, about what was happening, how food was staying on the docks while, you know, people seemed to be paying attention to other things. But on balance, as you look back, you have to say, boy, that was a very impressive and successful relief effort. You know, had that not happened, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people would have died. And so sure, there were problems. There were a lot of dumb things that happened and things that shouldn't have happened, things that could have happened better, but you know, but on balance, it was made a big difference.
Well, what do you think the solution is then? It apparently isn't so simple as just sending them food, or sending them plows or what? Or seeds?
No. The solution is first of all, has to come from within the countries themselves overwhelmingly, and that is, you know, they've got to develop the policies and the economic strategies that are going to enable people to get jobs, to produce more food, to see that poor people, the people who are on the fringes or even outside of the economy, are going to be able to participate in it and benefit from it. Now, you know, that's got to happen above all else. Now, there are things that we can do as a country to help encourage that to happen and to assist its implementation. We can do that through aid when it's properly targeted and put into the right kind of things in the right places. We can do it through, you know, through trade legislation that would provide more trade opportunities for developing countries. But again, as I say, that's linked to the unemployment problem here.
Well, most of the developing countries really don't have much to export, though, do they?
Well, they've got more to export than they can export. I mean, they would love to have more open markets.
Well, they have to be the right political persuasion before they can become a most favored nation.
Well, that's one of the problems.